I know you guys have shiur soon. Okay, couple of Rashi's about the Mun. Part of the Parsha that a lot of people skip over because it's a little anticlimactic. It's such a drama leading up to the Yamsuf and Kriyas Yamsuf and then Amalek, the end of the Parsha. So this is a Mun in the middle, and it's very long and there's a lot of descriptions. So Rashi helps us understand some of the behind-the-scenes Mun messages. Oh, it's a little bit ironic that a lot of guys have lost their taste. So I have to think about the Mun, where you could just make it taste like whatever you want. So when you eat tonight, tell you guys, make believe it's the Mun. And you can just taste the psychological. Okay. So the Torah says that the Mun melted. V'cham ha-shemesh v'names. Why is this important to tell that it melted? Well, partially it's because that was part of the test. The test was, would they gorge? Would they hoard the food? Would they trust that HaKadosh Baruch Hu would provide the next day? So whatever they tried to store, and certainly the Mun that was left in the field, would disappear. And all of a sudden, these people would see their Mun. And remember, you're in the desert. You know, you talk about Holocaust survivors mentality and your grandparents. I saw it in many of my parents' generation, where they couldn't waste food. It was just so difficult for them to waste food. In our day today, I throw out a lot of food in my house. It's not really about tashlis, because the volume of food, Baruch Hashem, in the modern world that we have access to cheaply, means you bake a lot for Shabbos, you know, maybe Orchim will come, as Rabbi says in Gemara Masechta, maybe Orchim will come, and we always have tons of food, and we end up throwing out food. And for people in my parents' generation, your grandparents' generation, it's just, it's heresy to throw out food, because they just live without food, and every time they could see food, they would just try to grab it. So this is what the Jews were like in the desert, without the trauma of the Holocaust, necessarily, but they weren't traumatized by Mitzrayim. And then they see the extra Mun in the field disappearing before their eyes. And hi, Ezra. And all of a sudden, they have to believe that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will return tomorrow with more Mun. So it's really a test of Emunah for Am Yisrael. But Rashi has a very interesting story. Rashi says, and this is the reason the Torah is stressing the melting Mun, is that the leftover Mun liquefied. And the leftover Mun turned into a river. And where did that river flow? Fascinating image. A lot of people don't know this. Turned into a river in the desert, I guess an oasis of sorts. And rams and gazelles and other types of desert animals would come and drink from that oasis. And then people would trap and capture those animals. And they would taste the Mun. So essentially, the taste of the Mun was enjoyed by non-Jews, because the Mun would melt. It turned into underwater springs or underground springs or oasis. Animals would come and drink that Mun liquid. And then when you would capture those animals, they would taste what the Mun is like. Fascinating. So the Mun was not a uniquely Jewish experience. It was something that everyone had a sense of. And part of this is, of course, to spread the Nisim of Hashem. So much of Shemos is not just emancipating the Jews from Mitzrayim and breaking the back of Paro, but introducing HaKadosh Baruch Hu to this world. And remember, keep in mind that this is 200 years after the great famine that afflicted humanity in Bereishis, but people are still traumatized by that famine. So now they're realizing that HaKadosh Baruch Hu provides our food from heaven in a literal sense, and that he'll be there to provide food. Remember, Baruch Hashem, we live in a world in which feeding ourselves, people don't die of hunger. You go back 300 years ago, people died of hunger. So in that reality, in Mitzrayim and Sefer Bereishis, in the world of Mitzrayim and Sefer Bereishis, people were dying of hunger. So now HaKadosh Baruch Hu is teaching the world that he'll provide for them through the Mun. But what's also fascinating is they don't just see the Mun as coming from Hashem, but they know that the Jews are eating the Mun. This is the leftover food from the Jews. And it's the first time in history that the Jewish people are fulfilling that role of providing welfare for the entire world. So you'd sit down at your table, you'd be in Iraq, you'd be in Egypt, you'd be in whatever, in Persia somewhere, and you just got this delicious, delicious gazelle that someone caught in the desert and ported it 5,000 kilometers to Persia, to Tehran or something. And you sat down and you ate it and said, where did this come from? Oh, this is Jewish meat. This is the meat that the Jews eat every day in the desert. And our role is, of course, physically, materially, and spiritually to try to provide for an entire world. You know, I don't know how this coronavirus is landing, and I don't know where it's heading, but I think there's a lot of conversation in Israel about, was it the right choice for Israel to offer to become lab rats or to become part of the study as to the effects of COVID? Now, you could tackle that question on two fronts, from two angles. You can tackle that question from a purely medical angle, scientific angle. What degree of privacy do you want to compromise in order to get your vaccines earlier? I would make that choice any day. I'd be happy to save my life by giving up some of my privacy because no one really knows my name. They just know there's a 54-year-old male who lives in a lunch food who got two vaccines and they're going to chart me. Like, they don't really know who I am. But I'd be more than happy to give my name if I could save my life. But some people would disagree with that. But I think we have to think of that question as every question in Israel, not just practically and medically, but also historically. This is our role as Jews. And if taking the vaccine can help the world advance towards health a little bit sooner, a little bit quicker, a little bit easier, then again, we don't want to endanger ourselves for humanity. But to the degree that it's not a danger, it's just an inconvenience or it's a lack of privacy, well, that's what it means to be a Jew, is to try to worry about people beyond your orbit and worry about how billions of people are going to be healthy as quickly as possible. So I think there's, you know, I thought of this rush, you know, reminded me of, oh, the Gentiles were eating our mun-tasting animals, and here we are in 2021, and our COVID tests are affecting the entire world's ability to recover. Okay, interesting. Another interesting Rashi. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells Moshe to hit the rock, to hit the rock and to draw water. This is in Perek Yud Zayin. So Hashem says, take your staff. But he tells Moshe, take your staff with which you struck the Nile River. As far as I know, Moshe only had one staff. It's not like he was a golfer. And he had a whole bunch of, take the 4-iron, take the 10-iron. Like, why is Hashem telling him, oh, your staff that you hit the Nile with. Like, it's a staff. The picture is of Moshe. He's walking with his one staff. He's, oh, wait a second. I'm sorry. I didn't know my video was off. I'm sorry, guys. Okay. He's walking with his staff. And like, why is Hashem telling him, take the staff that you hit the Nile with? Just to take your staff. Take your mateh. So Rashi says, Matamud Lomar Shir Hakisa Bo Sayor. Why is this important? Ella, Shehu Yisrael Omer Melamata Sheinu Muchen Ella Peronios. People are looking at that staff. That's the staff of the devil. That's the staff. That's a demon staff. That's the staff that causes people to suffer. Bo Laka Par Mitzrayim. It caused so much suffering and disease and affliction. Kama Makos Be Mitzrayim Be'al Yam. Not just in Mitzrayim, but on the Yam. We read the night of Pesach. There's a fivefold augmentation at the Yamsuf, because in Mitzrayim it's Etzba Lukimi, at the Yamsuf it's Yad Hashem, so it's 250 makos potentially at the Yam. They all come from Moshe's staff. It's a staff of death. Hashem says, take the very staff that you use to deliver disease and suffering, and now use it to deliver life. Yiru atash af letovu muchan. Hashem wants them to see that this staff is also capable of providing life. Why are we defending the reputation of the staff? Like, all of a sudden, the staff's going to be, you know, I don't know, it's going to get less hits on its Instagram page, you know, the staff, you know, hashtag staff of Moses. Like, why are we interested in how people look at the staff? The answer is, it's not about the staff. It's about HaKadosh Baruch Hu. This whole episode of Yetzias Mitzrayim is introducing HaKadosh Baruch Hu to a world of paganism, a world of pagans who thought that Hashem was always angry, that Hashem was always vengeful, that Hashem always punished man. Because that's all they saw until Avram taught them differently. They saw floods and population dispersal and expulsion from Gan Eden. They thought, look at the ancient renditions of pagan gods. They're all grotesque figures with teeth and horns and furrowed brows and scary, scary figures. That's how man saw God, as his enemy, a very strong enemy, but as his enemy. And Avram had tried so hard to convince the world, no, Hashem wants life, Hashem wants welfare, Hashem wants people to thrive. So now HaKadosh Baruch Hu is continuing this process, but on a grander historical scale. And that's all people have seen so far. And that's just how they're going to view the staff. Hashem is descended to Mitzrayim, 10 major, major packages of suffering, 250 on the Yamsuf, all these dead bodies. And I think, oh, God is just another one of those pagan gods who gets angry at humanity. So Hashem is saying, no, there was a time in which these makos were necessary. But that same staff that you took and created all this disease and discomfort, I want it to be a life-creating force. I want it to create man. I want it to draw mayim. I want people to realize I'm melech hachayim, melech hafetz b'chayim. I'm not a melech that desires people to die or desires people to suffer. Remember in the Haggadah, you say four psukim in the section called Arami Oved Avi, and the fourth pasuk talks about the Yetzias Mitzrayim. It's a four pasuk synopsis of Yetzias Mitzrayim. Ve'etzienu Hashem Elokeinu Misham, b'yad chazakah, Uvizran Tuya, Uvi Otot, Uvi Moftim. And how does that God that's based on the Medrash interpret Otot? Uvi Otot Zeh Mateh. Because in Shemot, HaKadosh Baruch Hu calls the Mateh an Otot, Mateh Shetasa Be'Otot. that Hashem's, even when he gives the mateh to Moshe and Shemos, he's saying, this is not going to be for makot. It's not a mateh of makot. It's a mateh for otot. Some of them will be makot. Some of them will be life. When is Moshe's mateh? Or maybe Moshe's mateh's cousin make this triumphant return and remind people that Hashem is a melech hachayim. What am I discussing right now? Parshas Chukat. Right after there's been more death and Meraglim and Korach and Amzat Parshas Korach and Meraglim, and so they put the staffs into, remember, they put the matot into the Beis HaMikdash and Aaron's mateh. It's not clear whether it's Aaron's mateh or Moshe's mateh. It's called Aaron's mateh. Starts to flower and produce fruit. And Hashem is saying, I'm not a, because there's been so much death that they tell Moshe, Atem Hamitem Etam Hashem, you killed us. There's so much death. There's Korach and there's Magefot. And Hashem is reminding them, no, it's not about death and it's not about. Okay, so that's an interesting Rashi. Third, final interesting Rashi. A little bit good message for people who are still stuck in quarantine. Videi Moshe kivedim. Moshe's hands were heavy, and therefore he required Aaron v'chor to hold his hands up during the war. So why were Moshe's hands heavy? So you'd think, because it's just really hard to hold your hands up for 12 hours. Try it. Nice way to torture yourself. Yeah, an older person, Moshe's an older person. His hands are really heavy. Rashi says no. Bishvil she nisatzel b'mitzvah umana acher tachta. Rashi's critiquing Moshe a little bit, that he didn't fulfill the mitzvah to lead the Jews into battle as much as he should have. He delegates to Yoshua, b'char lanu anashim, nisyakru yadav. Very interesting. Nisyakru yadav. His hands become not heavy, but precious, important. What's Rashi saying? Is this a punishment? A punishment to Moshe for laziness? Since you were lazy, Hashem will make his hands heavy, like after a vaccine, your hands are all heavy, or after, you know, get some Novocaine into your mouth, you can't move your mouth after the dentist puts some Novocaine, you feel heavy. I don't think it's a punishment to Moshe. I think it's a cause and effect. Sometimes people are lazy. What causes laziness? So sometimes there's laziness that people just don't like to work hard. Sometimes there's laziness that's based on fear. We call it procrastination, that you don't want to do things that you dread. But sometimes you're just lazy because you think too highly of yourself. You're saying, like, what? I'm not the person that should be doing that. Let someone else do that. That's beneath my dignity, beneath my station. I shouldn't be doing that. I shouldn't be. It's not really laziness as we refer to it. It's just, you know, I'm and it's fascinating because Moshe is such an anav, and he retains it anivos throughout the entire Torah. That's his calling card. But here Rashi is critiquing him a little bit. He was nisatzel b'mitzvah. He was a little bit lazy because he should have said, you know, I'm Moshe, but I can still go to battle. In the beginning of the parsha, he's not lazy at all. He takes out the atzmos Yosef, as we talked about on Wednesday night. He doesn't delegate that. But by the end of the parsha, he delegates a little bit too much to Yoshua. And because of that, because he sees himself as not too high, but it's a little bit beneath me, I'll delegate it to other people. So he holds too highly of himself. And again, in a very, very slight, subtle Moshe term. It's not like what we think arrogant and condescension. And because of that, the laziness just becomes more, and it's harder to, his hands become too yakar. It's harder to lift the hands because when you think too highly of yourself, it's sometimes harder to just do basic, simple tasks. So it's not Hashem is punishing him or because you were lazy and can make your hands too heavy. It's a reality. Once, again, this is very, very subtle. It's at a Moshe Rabbeinu level will never reach. But once you start to think a little bit too much of yourself, then laziness sets in. So the way to not be lazy in life, many, many ways not to be lazy, but one way not to be lazy is not to think too hard. Nothing should be too low for you. I know that they're switching American presidents now. So one of my favorite underrated presidents, he won't be on Mount Rushmore, trust me. One of my favorite underrated presidents, Gerald Ford. Gerald Ford was a great healer. In many ways, you could say similar to what Biden tries to become, because the nation is very, very torn after Watergate and after the debacle of Nixon. And, you know, you can make an easy parallel between Nixon and Trump and, you know, Ford and Biden. So Ford wasn't elected, at least initially, he just stood in after Nixon resigned. Anyway, he was very, very clumsy, very awkward. He would fall down the steps on Air Force One. Like, he'd get off the plane. Saturday Night Live had a field day with him. Like, they'd mock him and they'd fall down. He'd fall down the steps whenever he'd walk. But he was very, very moral. He was raised in Ohio. He'd quote his father. And he said, my father used to tell me, I think I once heard him say this in a speech. He was delivering a speech in Boca Raton. And he got caught in a rainstorm, a monsoon. And he walked into the convention hall with 20,000 people. He was drenched. His suit was all crumpled. He didn't have much hair. He was very bald. Like, his hair was sticking out. He didn't look dignified. So he began his speech by saying, "My father once told me," he quoted his father from Ohio, "my father once told me that dignity is not of the cloth and it's not of the wallet, but it's of the spirit." I mean, I've seen a lot of people who dress fancy, who are very wealthy. They don't know the first thing about dignity. And I've seen a lot of people who are poor and they carry themselves. And there's a dignity should never come from outside. It should come from within. You could be taking out the garbage, you're the most dignified person. You could be dancing with little kids, you're the most dignified person. Don't ever say, "I'm too dignified for this." A, it will make you lazy. B, it will reroute what dignity really is. Dignity is who you are inside. Obviously, people who have read or heard of Viktor Frankl writes a lot about this in his description of trying to keep your dignity under the strain of the Holocaust. But Moshe, at a little point, says, "You know, that's not for me. Not for me." Laziness sets in. Okay. Welcome back, Eitan. See you tonight.
Thank you, Rotarian.
You're welcome. Thanks for coming, Ezra. You're welcome. Good Shabbos, Mark.
Shabbos.
Shabbos.